Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world all around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Thanks for downloading, subscribing, rating. We really appreciate it. If you know someone who might be interested in this program, send them this episode. It's a good one. We're going to be talking about CAR T therapy because during the week I entered St. James's Hospital to see the cryobiology stem cell lab and how they infuse patients with reprogrammed T cells to kill cancer. Absolutely fascinating research. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com. We're going to get to your comments at the end of the program. But as always, we're going to start off looking back at the week's science news. We're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and science communicator Fergus McAuliffe. This is a really interesting one, Ruth, because we've been talking for quite some time about the lack of antibiotics, antibiotic microbial resistance, and how we need to come up with solutions very, very fast.
Yeah, we do. And as you say, you know, about 5 million people die every year because we simply don't have a suitable drug, an antibiotic, to give them when they get an infection from a drug-resistant bug. And this is a real problem because there's very few incentives for companies to develop new antibiotics. You know, most of the easy ones to find, we've already found. And if even if you do find a really new, good antibiotic, generally practitioners want to keep that on the shelf and they only want to give it when literally there's no other option. So you're not going to make a lot of money out of a new antibiotic. So it's
been, that's because the international policy worldwide has been don't give out any new antibiotics because
we get more resistance.
Yeah.
Exactly. So this is a big problem. And this a new research just came out. It was published in Cell. It's from researchers at MIT over in the US. And the goal of this project was to use generative AI to see if we could find some new antibiotics much more effectively and cheaply. So what the team in MIT did was they used AI to design over 36 million candidate molecules that could be antibiotics. So often when we're looking for a new drug, think of it like we're looking for a key to fit into a lock and we keep trying different keys to see if they fit in the lock. There was 36 million keys that we could quickly look at. But the interesting thing was how they generated that library. So they gave the AI fragments of other molecules. They also gave it lots of information about the type of sites where in antibiotic in bacteria where you tend to use where you can attack a bacteria. But they also just asked it to imagine new types of molecules and drugs. So that's how they created this huge library. And then they used the AI to screen to find compounds that might work as antibiotics. So they looked for things that they wouldn't be toxic to human cells, they weren't too similar to antibiotics that we already have, and could we actually make them in the lab? Mm. And did they look like they might hit part of a bacteria?
I was going to ask that because, you know, it's all very well AI identifying a molecule that, you know, that can do amazing things. If we can't find a way to synthesize that, then it doesn't really matter.
Exactly. So they did all of that. And that's so many steps in the searching for an antibiotic. So they found they got 24 compounds that they were able to successfully synthesize in the lab.
Wow.
They then looked in sort of just using in vitro petri dishes, looking at bugs. 7 of them showed activity, but they found 2 kind of ones that looked particularly promising. One of them was effective against drug-resistant gonorrhea, and the other one was effective against MRSA, Staph aureus, that's resistant to drugs. And they actually used those in mouse models, and they both worked successfully.
In terms of like high dose, or is there any, I'm looking for caveats here in what sounds like an amazing story.
So they effectively eliminated an MRSA skin infection and they eradicated a drug-resistant gonorrhea in mice. So not in humans, in mice, but it's incredibly positive. And I think what's possibly most exciting about these two compounds is structurally they're unlike any other antibiotic that we've seen. So they both appear to disrupt the cell membrane of the bacteria. And one of them possibly taps an unknown bacterial protein.
So that was going to be my question. When you're creating new compounds, how are you going to avoid causing damage to cells, causing damage to tissue, disrupting cell pathways, the sort of things that, you know, the unintended consequences of making something we haven't seen before in nature?
Yeah. And I suppose you have to, when you look at something like AlphaFold, you know, we're at the stage now where we're in silico creating models of every protein that exists everywhere. And that's the level of data that these, computers are now taking in and analysing in so many different dimensions that I think it is hard for us to get our head around it. And, you know, I guess with all the hype around AI, you know, the question is, was it ever going to produce anything that useful? And the reality is the AI in this case and the algorithms that were used do seem to have screened out a lot of those problems. Now, you go from 36 million down to 2.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a high attrition rate, but it's done very efficiently. So, you know, some researchers are kind of hailing this as a landmark moment in how we might join the battle or win the battle against superbugs.
Well, it is really, really encouraging because, of course, you know, medicine is seen as one of the two the earliest frontiers for a huge advancement in AI. We do hear more and more of these stories. It's great to hear because that is exactly what we need when it comes to something like antibiotic resistance. Our second story, Fergus, has to do with puberty.
Yes. So it has to do with both puberty, but also this theory called antagonistic pleiotropy theory. And this is a theory of evolution. And essentially, what it states is that natural selection favours genes that enhance reproductive success early on in life. But there's a downside to that insofar as those same genes then are compromised in aging and decline later in life. So there's essentially this evolutionary trade-off that's happening. And the evidence for this theory is limited in humans up until this study. So this is a really nice study that was done in the Buck Institute for Research on Aging, where they looked at genetic data from almost 200,000 women in the UK Biobank.
Right.
And they found about 150 genetic markers that are linked to reproductive timing. And what they found was that if a female underwent puberty early, i.e. before the age of 11, or childbirth early, i.e. before the age of 21, then that was associated with a higher risk of diabetes, obesity, and cardiovascular problems later in life.
Yeah. Now, how much higher?
For various different measures, it ranged between 2 to 4 times.
Kind of wow. Okay. So significant. Yes. Yeah. Wow.
And then on the flip side, later puberty and later childbirth are genetically associated with a longer lifespan, with lower frailty, and slower aging.
Wow. Yeah. And the childbirth one really is counterintuitive for me because, you know, I remember, it must have been years ago, a teacher telling me about Romeo and Juliet and how Romeo and Juliet would have been 13, 14 years old. And that actually, you know, 16 is actually, you know, from a physical point of view, probably one of the best times to have a baby. But that's, you know, not what we do culturally anymore, right? That actually early children, I would have thought, would have conferred a better advantage. But this seems to say later childbirth is... Yes. Is better?
Well, kind of. So if the sole criteria of success is reproduction, it is better to reproduce earlier in life.
Right.
However, reproduction is no longer the sole criteria of success because everyone wants a lifespan after that, what the health span. And so this particular study it really sheds light on, I guess, the implications of both early puberty, but also early childbirth. Because if we look into the data, so since the 1970s in the US, the average age of the onset of puberty in females is falling by about 3 months per decade.
Right.
And when we think of, okay, well, what are the potential...
That's pretty significant, right?
It is a big change. But on top of that, it opens up doors and conversations around, well, how do we treat women's health in the context of this new information, whereby women's health is no longer sort of confined to obstetrics and gynecology, but kind of leaving the rest of the canvas blank. Because if you can understand, if you can go all the way back to asking a female patient, well, what was the first onset of your period, or what age were you if you had your first child, then you can come up with a more tailored approach to how you manage their health.
Right. Yeah.
So it's almost like evolution has optimized us for reproduction rather than retirement. And the task now that we have is
rebalancing
the health system that would bend towards changing that legacy.
Very interesting. Our third story, Ruth, has to do with plastics. We've talked about plastics for many time. We're talking about, you know, early onset puberty. Now we're talking about fertility. How bad is this fertility problem?
I mean, the reason why we're talking about this week is because, you know, the UN has been convening many countries to sign up to a treaty to cut down on plastic pollution. And I suppose why it's in the news is because essentially those talks have failed. And they failed because, you know, the countries that produce fossil fuels, which is the raw material to produce plastics, have not signed, and they haven't come up with an agreed text. And so researchers that are looking at this issue are out making statements this week. And one of those is Dr. Shanna Swan from the School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York. And her team has been looking at sperm counts in males, looking back over many decades. And I think the headline finding is that the rate of sperm count decline has doubled in about the last 10 years. So this is based on a number of meta-studies. The first study was published back in 2017 that looked at 185 studies looking at over 42,000 men, and it showed there'd been a 50% drop in sperm count in Western countries between the early 1970s and 2011. And then a follow-up study 3 years ago looked at other countries as well. So it wasn't just Western countries, it was countries in the global south. And we could see that the rate is speeding up. So that is worrying. And you might say, so at the moment, it looks like the average sperm count has dropped from about 100 million per mil to about 49 million per mil.
Wow.
Now, 49 million is still an awful lot.
You only need one.
You only need one. Although you kind of don't only need one, because really, once a man's sperm count falls below about 15 million per mil, that's where fertility issues kick in.
Right.
And below 10 million per mil, you're
effectively sterile.
Yeah, and about 50% of infertility is attributable to what's going on with the man. And I suppose if this rate continues, you know, you can quite quickly get to a point, where we're getting to really problematic infertility rates. And I think the other issue is we are seeing plastics, particularly endocrine disrupting chemicals, so things like phthalates, things like bisphenol. You sometimes see BPA-free plastic, that's plastic without bisphenol. But we're finding these in males in utero, and what we're finding is these are interfering with male reproductive systems forming when they're in utero. So we're seeing the cells that actually produce sperm, the Sertoli cells, there's fewer of those in boys where there's high exposure to plastic. So it's almost like an assault, not just on the number of sperm, it's on the quality of sperm, it's on the number of cells that are able to produce sperm.
And in the West, like, you know, people think, there's very little we can do. I mean, you can try and reduce your exposure to plastic as much as possible, but really, it's in everything. It's in everything around us.
I mean, we now know we're breathing in microplastic and they're getting into our brain and we're eating it. I mean, we can do what we can, but it's difficult and I think it's worrying.
Mm. Our final story, Fergus, has to do with aging as well, but this time a new protein.
Yeah, so we've just found a protein that reverses brain aging, but only in mice, unfortunately.
So far.
So what the research team in the University of California in San Francisco did was they were looking at how genes and proteins in the hippocampus changed over time in mice. Now, the hippocampus, it's the part of the brain that's associated with learning and with memory. What they did is they found one protein in particular called FTL1. And in old mice, you have much higher levels of this protein FTL1. And on top of that, you have fewer connections between the brain cells and the hippocampus, which ultimately leads to diminished cognitive abilities. Experimentally then, what they did was that when they increased the amount of FTL1 that was present in young mice, and when they did that, what happened was that both their brains and their behaviour began to resemble that of old mice, i.e. with poor memory performance in mazes and less interest in novel objects in the standardized tests that they give to mice.
I love that. I mean, like, I love that that's a measure of being old. So what?
Exactly. Yeah,
Like, oh, look at this. I've got new stuff. Look at this new technology. Yeah, I don't care. Yeah, I don't care.
It's literally like two square blocks in the corner of a compartment, and then they change one square one for a round one, and if the mouse goes over and interacts with it or not, it's that novel and that simple. Now, the real kicker then is that they flipped the experiment. So when they reduced the amount of FTL1 in the hippocampus of the older mice, they actually regained a lot of their youthful ability to remember and to learn.
Wow.
And they also had more connections between their brain cells, and they did better on the memory tests. Now, huge caveat here, this is just the mouse model, right? But it looks like we're opening the door on one particular protein that seems to be highly associated with and consequential for both memory and cognition.
Can I buy this online?
Not yet, but watch this space. We shall see.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the area of aging has been of increasing fascination to so many researchers. You know, I think we have a summit here. There's a lot of people interested in aging and particularly de-aging.
Yeah. I mean, between this and the recent work on psilocybin, there won't be any old mice left.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's really interesting stuff. Interesting to see where it'll go. Obviously, the next step is human models and so on.
Exactly. Yeah.
Dr. Fergus McAuliffe, Dr. Ruth Freeman, thank you very much. All right, on the way, we go to the Dublin Cryobiology Stem Cell Lab in James's to see how they're using next generation technology to cure cancer. Stay with us. Welcome back to Future Proof on News Talk. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the program, you can email us at science@newstalk.com. Now, our healthcare service, if you read the papers, it gets a huge amount of flack. But actually, there's an extraordinary amount of amazing research and medicine going on right under our noses. This week, I went to St. James's Hospital to visit the cryobiology laboratory, where they're giving a revolutionary technology therapy to patients to literally cure some of them from cancer. Absolutely unheard of up to literally a decade ago. Dr. Larry Bacon is a consultant hematologist from St. James's who joins us now to kind of give us a bit of an overview, and then we'll play you some clips and some audio from my trip to St. James's. Welcome to the program, Larry. Before we talk about the treatment and hear from Nicola in the lab, maybe you might tell me a little bit about how we traditionally have treated blood cancers and why that needed to change.
Yeah, okay. So thanks, Jonathan. So blood cancers are a type of cancer that we sort of, such as multiple myeloma, such as non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which we've historically used to treat with what we call standard chemotherapy drugs. So these are sort of old-fashioned drugs, such as cyclophosphamide, vincristine, steroids, which have been used for years to treat all, you know, different types of cancers. And there was really no targeted therapy within them. So we know that these drugs can kill off cells. So an advantage, of course, was that we kill off the faster growing cells like cancer cells, but it also affected other cells in the body and led to significant toxicity. So there were good therapies. We still use some of these standard therapies, especially in frontline therapies, and they can be successfully used to treat some of our blood cancers. But when these cancers relapse, we know that they've found a mechanism able to evade standard chemotherapies, and that's where we can use and come in with our immunotherapies.
What exactly is an immunotherapy, and how does it differ to something like chemotherapy, which is essentially, as you say, a really sort of a toxic bomb on the site, which and can be quite damaging to patients?
Yeah, so the big advantage of immunotherapy is exactly as you said. They're not carpet bombing, they're very specific and will specifically target a cancer cell. So in the early days, our immunotherapies were very simple antibody therapies, and we use them in combination still with standard chemotherapies. But these drugs will be targeted to fight the cancer cell. So if we go back to our very first immunotherapy, a drug called rituximab, that was a therapy designed to target cells that express a CD20 antigen, if you like, or that cell, that cancer cell or that blood cancer cell is expressing a protein that we call CD20, and the immunotherapies are able to get in and find that CD20 cell and if you like, kill it and get rid of the cancer that way. So that was the very first specificities that we had, that we found a target, that cancer cell was expressing that, and we were able to kill the cancer cell specifically. And it generally left the other cells around it relatively safe, I guess.
Yeah, and I guess, you know, from a layman's point of view, it sounds like these immunotherapies are a way of training our immune system to see the sort of cells that they should be attacking, in this case, cancer cells.
In the older style, they were just directing against it, but in the newer immunotherapies, that's what we're doing. We're training our immune system to target the cancer cell.
And that's why I was really interested to go to the cryobiology lab, a stem cell facility at St. James's this week. And I met Dr. Nicola Gardner. She's chief medical scientist there. And she took me into the lab to see this incredible process and how it's done.
You're very welcome, Jonathan. This is the cryobiology stem cell facility at the National Blood Centre in St. James's Hospital. Our laboratory is involved in both bone marrow stem cell transplant and CAR T therapy. So for a CAR T patient, it starts back with apheresis. So the product is collected from the patient in apheresis. So apheresis is similar to hemodialysis. The patient is hooked up to the machine and the blood is drawn from one arm through the machine and returns to the patient.
Sort of like a circuit.
Exactly. And we are essentially hoovering out the cells that we want, which in this situation are the patient's T cells. We then get what looks like, from all intents and purposes, a bag of blood, and we bring it here to the laboratory. And we make sure to take a sample in a sterile fashion. So the facility that you see here, we have two clean rooms. And these are specialist clean rooms with grade A facilities, something similar to those that you would see in a pharmaceutical plant. They are actually GMP. So in the clean area, we will remove a sample from the bag and we will test it for sterility to make sure that there's the patient, the apheresis system, there's no introduction of any bugs, bacteria to the cells. We then take the cells, a sample, and we are assessing what kind of cells are in the bag. We're looking for a known volume of T cells. We need a T cell dose for the patient. So we take a sample and we incubate it in a test tube with antibodies that have a fluorescent marker on them. When the cells are then passed through a machine, such as this one here, a flow cytometer.
Which looks like a giant photocopier from here.
Yeah, it's a very expensive giant photocopier. But the flow cytometer will, it basically shoots the cells past a laser, and if the antibody is there and the fluorescent marker is on the cell, it will fluoresce. So every time the machine sees a T cell, it sends a spark and it will be counted. So we will know then from the number of cells the machine reads by the sample how many T cells are in the bag. So we're targeting to try and collect a certain dose of T cells for the patient so that we can prepare them for CAR T therapy.
So we can see a room full of medical scientists working on various machines and computers. And this is essentially, I suppose, Nicola, a quality assurance area where you're making sure that the donor, who is the patient themselves, that they have enough of the T cells to be able to partake in the treatment, yeah, that it is of good quality, that there's no material viruses or bacteria or molds that are going to affect the quality of the blood, yeah, and then you prepare it for what happens next.
So the next thing, these cells are going to be cryopreserved. So in the clean room, we will take the patient's plasma. So that dialysis or apheresis machine will separate a plasma bag as well. We prepare the plasma by cooling it. We add DMSO, dimethyl sulfoxide, to it. And this will protect the cells when they're being frozen and thawed, because they're at risk of bursting or lysing. So this gives it a kind of a little jacket to stop ice forming in the cells while it freezes. So we prepare the plasma DMSO, we add it to the cells, and we transfer them then into special bags that are going to withstand really low temperatures. So we're bringing the cells from room temp, from cold, 4 degrees, down to minus 190 degrees, so very, very cold, and storing them in liquid nitrogen.
So, and that happens in this sort of very sci-fi looking sort of
clean
empty room.
Yeah.
It's got two grey arms coming down from the ceiling. What are they for?
They are to decontaminate the room should we require them. They are hydrogen peroxide decontamination units.
Right, okay. So you don't want them to go off.
No, you don't want to be in the room when they go off.
Right, and then pretty much the only other thing in the room is the sort of hooded lab area, where I suppose that's where you ensure that it's super clean, super sterile, and there's no contamination.
Yeah, so in fact, when we're in that room, that's exactly the area that we work in. So it's called a biological safety cabinet. So it protects the cells, but it also protects the worker working at it. We work inside that, and that area is a grade A sterile area. And we can move the cells around between bags, we can take samples, we can add things to and from it, but it's a sterile area so that we know the cells are safe while they're there. So when we're in there, we wear a full suit. So it's rather like a hazmat suit. We wear a full hood, goggles, It's a full body suit with boots, double gloves, not very comfortable to work in, but it's the scientists will be, they're very specially trained for this clean room work.
So in that clip, Larry, we heard from Nicola, and she was saying, you know, for a lot of patients, it's last resort. Why is that? Why do we wait until four rounds of chemo before we offer CAR T to patients when they're diagnosed with a blood cancer? And why does the chemotherapy not work for them?
Okay, so there's always a group of people where the chemotherapy will work, and then a group for, unfortunately, where the disease relapses. In truth, Jonathan, it's quite a political question you're asking.
I know that. That's why I'm asking it.
And that's fine. It's okay to ask it. So that's a political question you're asking. And in truth, if these CAR T cell therapies were available in second and third line, that's exactly where we would use them. For right now, within our, you know, resources, we only have availability of these agents for third line therapy.
So what you're saying is they're very expensive, and because they're brand new, they're very expensive to do, and so we need to try, I suppose, more economical reasons, because that's what we're doing with the health budget.
Exactly.
It's impossible to give everyone the highest possible level of care straight away.
And these drugs can cost up to hundreds of thousands per patient. But again, that's a relatively small amount of money for a once-off therapy with a curative intent.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, there's lots of talks happening around the country trying to figure out how to get this sort of technology to patients quicker and sooner and before that fourth line. But I suppose we live in an economic reality as well. So this process is really interesting to see where it's happening was fascinating. Once the blood is ready for freezing, it goes to the cryobiology storeroom. Here's Nicola talking me through what happens there.
Okay, Jonathan, this is our cryobiology storeroom facility. So we have liquid nitrogen storage for cells when they're cryopreserved. And we prepare the cells inside in the clean room, and then they get passed out and they're cryopreserved using a control rate freezer. So the control rate freezer will bring the cells from room temperature to 4 degrees down to -180 across an hour and a half.
Wow.
Cells are then transferred into super cold storage in vapor phase liquid nitrogen.
Oh, wow. So Nicola's just taken the lid off a giant vat. It looks like an enormous milk churn, about the size of like a squatted a giant double American fridge. And you lifted that off, and the liquid nitrogen, the vapor kind of comes off the top of it. It's 190, minus 192.
So this is basically, it's a stainless steel vessel, and it contains liquid nitrogen at the base. So what you saw was cold vapor. The area above the liquid nitrogen is super cold. So you can see the temperatures here, the storage with two temperature probes, and it's cold at minus 190 degrees. So the cells are stored in that cold phase above the liquid nitrogen.
And they have been prepared in the lab previous to be ready for this, protecting the cells for freezing.
Yeah.
Why do we need to store them at all at this temperature? Why don't we just put them straight into the patient?
Well, we're storing them so that we can ship them, because the cells are going to Europe to be manufactured for genetic modification. They will go to either the Netherlands or they'll go to Switzerland for modification. So while they're in transit, they need to be, you know, protected. So we would only have a 24-hour shelf life on our products fresh. So they need to either be there in 24 hours or we cryopreserve them so that they go frozen. They're safe when they're frozen.
They don't go.
They come back to us frozen as well.
Do they travel in these giant tins?
No, they travel in one of these guys. So these are small shippers. So again, this is like a miniature version of what you're seeing there. We've heard these described as Daleks. It depends on
a mini Dalek.
This goes, it can go internationally. So during COVID, we ship cells to Australia, New Zealand during COVID shutdown.
Wow. So it looks like a Dalek or a bin, And it has temperature probes coming out of it, and it's on wheels. So this is the transportable version of it.
When the cells are in this, again, it's I can open it. It's got the cold vapor in it. It's still at minus 190 degrees. The cells are safe in that. And we bring them to the bedside, and the cells are actually thawed at the bedside. So this goes to the patient's bedside, and the cells are thawed and literally infused immediately to the patient.
So these cells that the patient has donated, you've checked the quality of them, they go off to Europe. What are they doing with them in Europe?
So what they do is they will take the T cells and they will incubate them with a special, what's called a CAR antigen. So it is a chimeric antigen receptor on the T cell. So it's basically training the T cell to see the disease. So the CAR or the antigen is specific to the disease type, and the cells will then express the antigen on their surface, and it's like putting blinkers on a horse. That T cell will now only see disease. So what they do then is they multiply those cells, they grow them in a flask, for want of a better term. They grow over the next 6 or 7 days. Then they will freeze them down in the same fashion that we do, and then they do all the QC testing before it's released. So it takes about 28 days for the cells which leave here today to come back for the patient. And when they come back again in one of these shippers, slightly larger industrial kind of one. When they arrive, they're a medicinal product, but it's a bag of cells. It's exactly what we're used to handling. It's a small bag of cells. It can be as little as 20 mils of cells in a bag. The cells are kept here, so you can see behind you there a smaller version of the vessels, which is specific only for CAR T products. Because they're genetically modified cells, they're kept separate. And we will then give the clinical team the thumbs up, the cells have arrived. One of the hugely important factors we have is ensuring that the patient cells are traceable the whole way along. So if we have a patient, John Doe, at the beginning with his date of birth and his MRN, and all the numbers applying to it are on the cells when they're collected during apheresis, when they're frozen here in the lab, when they're shipped and when they come back, we have to make sure that there's been the paperwork and all the numbering is exact, because these are the patient's own cells. So we have to be absolutely 100% sure we're giving the patient back their own cells that have been genetically modified.
There's so much effort, isn't there, going into this one person's treatment. When you look at the facilities here, the time and effort, the shipping and so on. But for patients who respond to CAR T, this is an absolute game changer, isn't it, this technology?
Absolutely. It is a huge amount of work and expense and time goes into each individual patient, but that would be the case with a transplant patient or with a CAR T patient. But those 20 mils of cells or 60 mils of cells can revolutionize a patient's life. We have one patient who's our longest survivor, who's 4 years post-transplant, and he's completely cured of his cancer. He has no disease. He is a healthy, happy person who comes to lots of different events for us, and he's very happy to tell me the only thing he takes every morning is his vitamins. And he's an inspiration to us as to why we would do this.
So it's really amazing that these cells get sent off to Europe to get reprogrammed to work in a way that's going to attack that cancer. And what's amazing is then it just travels back to the patient's bedside. What is the significance of the fact that, this infusion is happening right at the side of the patient's bed?
The cells are sent away for processing, they come back, and then patients are sitting in their bed, and we take these cells in a frozen container over to their bedsides, and with the use of central lines, we just reinfuse the cells in a process of about 20 or 30 minutes. And these new cells then get into the body and then start to target the cancer almost immediately. But not only are they targeting the cancer, they're also growing and multiplying, so they're like a living drug, and they stay within the body for up to as far as we can tell, for up to at least a year after we reinfuse the cells, and they stay there circulating and fighting the cancer during during that time, which is phenomenal. When you think you give a drug or a chemotherapy, the body is able to eliminate that drug after a certain period of time. So the huge advantage of these immunotherapies are these CAR T-cell therapies is the fact that they're a truly a living drug that continue to circulate in the body and continue to treat the lymphomas. I mean, it's interesting, we have some patients where we've reinfused these cells, and when we look at their tumour a month later, there's still some tumour left, and we don't do anything different. And then we look again at 3 months, the tumour's reducing in size. We look again at 6 months, and it may be obliterated and completely gone.
That's extraordinary.
It's an extraordinary and a really novel therapy.
Well, it's really, really exciting to hear about the advancements. It was wonderful to visit the lab and hear from Nicola, Dr. Larry Bacon, consultant hematologist from St. James's. Thanks for your time.
Okay, thank you.
All right, time to look back at some of your comments from last week's show. And we were talking about slowing down aging with Eamon Mallon. He's a professor of evolutionary biology at the University of Leicester. Jamie says, I wonder what has been the biggest gap between someone's biological age and their epigenetic age. I think it's got to be one of the Rolling Stones, right? I'd say their epigenetic age is like 400, some of these lads. This should happen more often, because I meet lots of people who listen to the program and they like the program. They very rarely tell me that they hate the program. It could be true, but most people, when they come up, they say they like the program and they say, you should do this on your program, and then I forget. And actually, this is one of those cases. I'm going to read out the email. The person didn't want to be named, but they said, hi, Jonathan, I'm the person who spoke to you at the Dorky Book Festival. I remember this now. Around the age of 45, I first heard the word misophonia. Until then, I didn't realize it was a condition that others also suffer from. I say suffer, as certain noises cause extreme irritation to the auditory part of my brain. As a teenager, I could not stand my father's eating noises, tapping the spoon on the cup of coffee, other noisy habits such as heavy foot on the stairs and landing. When certain noises are predominantly related to eating irritate me, I have to extricate myself from the environment. It is impossible to concentrate on what I'm doing. It's like a sudden fire or explosion in my brain. I have to stop what I'm doing immediately. And once I've seen the offending person who has triggered this reaction, if they're still eating, I have to look the other way and ensure that that person is not in my line of vision. If you do decide to delve into this condition for your radio program, I'd be very interested in your findings. It was a thrill to meet you. I very much doubt that, but you're very kind. Fan of the program, and you were so kind to me with your time at the Dorky Book Festival. Listen, thank you so much for emailing this. We will definitely cover misophonia very, very shortly. So thank you very much for reminding me. We will do that. That's it from us on this week's episode. Thank you for listening. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Research Ireland.
Sundays from midday on News Talk.